Sie fahren in den Urlaub? Wir sind hier für Sie. Mit Kindern? Die auf der Rückbank hitziger debattieren als im Gerichtssaal? Darüber, welches Tablet lauter ist, welches Kabel schneller lädt und warum 100-mal denselben Trickfilm gucken ein Grundrecht ist? Ja, unsere Autos sind dem absolut gewachsen. Denn egal ob Roadtrip oder Geschäftsreise, wenn Ihr Flug Verspätung hat, Ihr Akku gleich aufgibt oder sich Ihr Hunger danach richten muss, was gerade offen hat, ja, auch dann sind wir für Sie hier. Enterprise, hier für Sie.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, U.S. Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me today, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, everybody.
And as usual, we're going to be talking about RPGs, big and small, Western, Eastern, console, PC. Doesn't matter. We love them all. And this is the podcast where we cover it. The Blood God loves the RPGs. Give him all of the RPGs.
Yeah, and it looks like this week is probably going to be pretty heavy on the Western front.
Nah, a little bit. I mean, I promise that I'm going to spare you all Destiny 2 talk because I don't think anybody listening to this podcast really cares. Like, every time I talk about Destiny 2, I get flack, and maybe there's a reason for that, and that's because Destiny 2 is, I mean, it's a shooter. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest. It's a co-op shooter. We went to the big Destiny reveal yesterday, and there was the usual pomp and circumstance and all that good stuff. But
all the marketing stuff.
Somebody at the actual event made a pretty good observation, and I'm going to steal it now. This is credit to Ben Silverman, who used to work over at Yahoo. He said that the thing that bugs him about Destiny 2 is that the world doesn't have any people in it.
Really? Like NPCs?
Like regular people. Mm-hmm. Like normal people. Like they're robots.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you know what? That would bore me because I'm going to commit a terrible sin here and say I'm not overly interested in robots, even though I'm like a huge Mega Man fan. But in a sci-fi context, you're just like, they're okay, I guess. But if you have like a world full of robots and like no biologicals, organics, I'd get kind of fed up after a while.
Well, let me rephrase that. There are biologicals, but they're all superheroes.
That's not much better.
Like, the tower doesn't have, like, accountants. Like, there are shopkeepers, but, you know, they're your typical, like, kind of RPG, like, hi, we're just kind of random NPCs and or robots. But you don't get any sense of, like, when you're fighting bad guys that you're saving anybody or that you're making a real difference.
Okay.
Everybody in this game is Batman.
Okay, yeah, because I remember hearing, I watched the reveal, and they had a whole, like, they had the whole intro where they were playing through it, and they're talking about how they're evacuating the civilians, but you don't see the civilians, and I guess once they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah, well, right, but you never see the civilians, yeah. So it doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah.
So, like, as a result, it doesn't feel like a lived-in world. The lore doesn't really feel like it matters at all. It's just a series of comic book supervillains that you're finding on a whole bunch of different planets, which exist solely as arenas for co-op shooting.
Mm-hmm.
So
shooty, shooty, bang, bang.
And that's the thing, is that, like, an RPG, I think, relies on its NPCs. It relies on the normals, as it were, to serve as a contrast to your, like, regular character, right?
Right.
And, I mean, it's the NPCs who, like, they add flavor and color to the world, like, when you really pay attention to the dialogue and what they can talk about. They can direct you to your next quest. They put everything into context, right?
Yeah, like when I was young, I'd always kind of feel bad for little kids who, they're like, my parents were kidnapped by the monster. I'd be like, oh, poor little guy, I got to save him.
Yeah, exactly. They make you want to save the world.
Mm-hmm.
And even in other MMORPGs, like World of Warcraft, like you see NPCs around, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see kind of the regulars. You have a real sense of place. Everything
yes.
kind of feels connected together.
Yes.
Everybody's not everybody's Batman.
Just some of the people
for role playing. And I think that's the thing with Destiny is that there's no room for role playing really. It's just shoot.
Yeah, that would be kind of disappointing, because the whole fun of an RPG is having that feeling of superiority over everyone. Like, yeah, you're helping them, but you're still, you are Batman, and they're all, I don't know, plebes. they're all Alfreds. No, Alfred's cool. I don't know my comic book lore very well.
But yeah, when there's no room for role-playing and it's all just action, then it's hard to characterize it as anything but like a shooter with some extra stats.
Mm-hmm. So you played a bit, and I guess this is, you would have a better idea of how this all felt than I would, but I guess you'd come to that conclusion then, huh?
I mean, I've spent a lot of time thinking about Destiny and everything, mm-hmm. but yeah, like, I played a little bit of it. It co-ops MMO RPG elements, like World of Warcraft, and puts them into a shooter context, and that's why it is popular, because mm-hmm. it makes those elements accessible.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of min-maxing. It's much more about how much are you willing to grind mm-hmm. to get the best gun.
Mm-hmm.
You're not sitting here like putting together like really complex DPS burst combos and like thinking about how you're actually going to help the party. You're just thinking like, okay, my character is kind of strong and tanky a little bit, and this guy has a big fire sword and can do their thing, and that, you know, like, right, like mm-hmm. there's no real sense of classes or anything. Like, everybody, there is teamwork, but otherwise, for the most part, it's kind of everybody out for themselves. But
yeah, you're not too...
I wouldn't talk too much about Destiny.
Yeah, because, well, I was going to ask you quickly, like, you're not too gung-ho on the first, as I recall, but does the second, I guess it doesn't sound like it alleviates any sort of, or encourages you to really play it, does it?
I mean, I'm going to play it.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
I'm probably just not going to talk about it much anymore on the podcast.
It's just going to be, like, background noise in your life and our lives.
I mean, I suppose, like, it's going to be one of the biggest games of the year.
Yeah.
It's impossible to ignore. You saw the pomp and circumstance that was going on. I can't believe Luke Smith is the director of Destiny 2.
Yeah, he's come a long way, that's for sure. Like, I met him at 1UP E3 2006. That was a long time ago.
It's just so weird, because he used to be, like, a podcast host over on 1UP, and now he's directing one of the biggest games in the... in the entire industry, so...
Yeah, he still looks very much the same.
Does he? He had already left by the time I started listening to One Up Yours, so mm-hmm. I guess I never, like, I knew that he was one of the most popular people on the show, but mm-hmm. I guess I never really got to know him until I looked on that stage and saw, he's just another guy up there on that stage hyping up a game to the moon.
Yep, talking about all those buzzwords.
To the moon with all the wizards on them.
That wizard came from the moon.
But on that note, let's talk about something else.
Let's
talk about Fire Emblem Shadows of Valentia, which I reviewed last week mm-hmm. while I was on the road, actually.
Wow, that's a good
on the
road game.
It was a very tiresome week, or this past week. Yeah, it was very tiresome.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot to write.
Cat did a lot of writing.
I did a lot of writing while also being like running around, going and checking out new games, which you will be hearing about over the course of the next month. But Shadows of Valentia, we talked a bit about it already mm-hmm. on this podcast, but I have some final thoughts on it, Nadia.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we're going to hear all about it, because some people have already let you know what they think on the comment thread of your review.
It's hard, mm-hmm. And not in a good way.
I
think that there's good difficulty and bad difficulty, and I think that this is too old school for its own good.
Mm-hmm. You're not the only one who says that, by the way. I have read other reviews where they say the same thing, where, okay, Shadows of Valentia is kind of in a weird niche, because, yes, it's a remake, but it really has to subscribe to those old mechanics, like, in some ways, and, well, by the sounds of it, it does.
I don't necessarily think so. I think a remake is an opportunity to completely revisit the old subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
I get that they want to be faithful to the spirit of the original, but they are being faithful to maybe a little more than the spirit.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that, like, in your review, that the real problem is their idea of making the game hard is throwing, like, enemy after enemy after enemy, just wearing you out instead of actually giving you, like, a technical challenge.
Well, yeah, it's like enemy spam, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is something that Bob always complains about in old NES games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are we going to do? Well, I guess we'll just fill the screen with enemies and like moving in weird patterns, and that's how we're gonna do. That's how we're gonna make it hard. It's like kind of an artificial difficulty. It's not the one that you can necessarily overcome easily with skill, but mm-hmm. it's a bit more like luck or attrition or grindy.
I'm actually just having this vision of like the battlefield, like in real life, and like the enemies just kind of moving around, like maybe doing cartwheels and all this weird shit, and the people who are supposed to fight them are like, what the hell is this? We're here, we're fighting crazy people, but fight like normal people. What's going on here?
So the thing that really drove me crazy, and did I mention this in the last episode of the podcast, are these enemies called canters?
I think so. They call up the enemies, like...
Yeah, they summon constant waves of enemies that are coming at you.
Okay, maybe
you mentioned. Oh my god, it drove me crazy, and it only gets worse. Oh my gosh.
And it's not even a situation where it's... Well, I haven't played the game yet, but it's not a situation where you can kind of get rid of the canter quickly and hope for the best before they can...
It varies. Mm-hmm. One of the characters gets a priest, mm-hmm. and she has the ability warp. Mm-hmm. So if you play it right, you can totally warp Alm, who is the main male character, over mm-hmm. and like kill it really fast. Mm-hmm. But of course, he might get surrounded and killed pretty fast himself.
And then it's game over, right?
Yeah. So there's like some serious risk reward going on there. Mm-hmm. Or you can try and snipe them with the bow and arrow, mm-hmm. but more often than not, you're going to get hemmed in by all sides.
Yeah.
By like the six enemies that they've just spawned, plus all the enemies on the map and everything. And you can use the terrain, but the actual map is quite open, so there are not a lot of ways to like be able to hunker and kind of protect your party, like protect your flanks. Mm-hmm. Your flanks are constantly exposed in this game. Mm-hmm. I started kind of huddling in the corner and just like
waving
trying
your stick
to like beat off the waves of enemies that are coming in.
Oh man.
I found myself relying really heavily, like more heavily than I would have liked on the main character.
Yeah.
It was hard to build everybody up at kind of the same rate. It's a game that very much encourages grinding. And mm-hmm. in fact, I interviewed the developers earlier this week, and they were like, I mentioned that this was probably the hardest Fire Emblem I've ever played. Mm-hmm. Like, see, maybe the only Fire Emblem I've played where I went, oh man, am I going to actually be able to beat this? Because holy crap, that final level, mm-hmm. it's a nightmare. And they were like, well, this game is a very heavy on role-playing elements. So if you're having a hard time, we would suggest that you grind in the dungeons.
Oh, thank you. I never considered
that.
And
I was like, oh, okay. So, but that really gives you a window into their mindset, right?
Yes, exactly.
Where they're like going, we're not necessarily like thinking in terms of like making really like well-made maps or anything. Mm-hmm. We're like just pulling those straight from the Famicom version. And if you're having a hard time beating them, like, you just got to brute force it with, like, higher level characters.
Goodness. Or just get a game genie.
What was that article that you wrote earlier today about Canadian game genies?
Oh, you didn't get to read it yet?
No, I didn't.
Basically, it was an ad that my husband found in one of his old game magazines that he was going through. And it was like a quote-unquote Thank You Canada ad because Game Genie was available in Canada when it wasn't available in the United States because there were all these lawsuits going on over the hardware. So it was kind of I say a thank you, but it was really kind of a, hey, Americans, why don't you come over up here? Here's where it's on sale. Here's a list of stores. It's pretty great. It's very 90s.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, no, that's an interesting piece of history. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those were the days when you would totally break out a cheat device like the Game Genie because, oh my God, games were unfairly hard. And why were they unfairly hard? Because there wasn't a lot of memory in them and they needed to extend the experience somehow. Mm-hmm. So they would just, I mean, it's kind of that old arcade mentality, right? Mm-hmm. Like, well, so what? You're going to die. Deal with it.
More quarters.
More quarters. Nom nom.
Nom 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 quarters.
You will get your $50 worth out of this game because you will die a lot and it's fine.
Oh man, that brings back some flashbacks. Just remembering... And not only were games hard back then, but a lot of American localized games were made harder so that we couldn't finish them in a rental. And God, Castlevania 3, if you died at Dracula, who had three stages, you couldn't just start at Dracula again. You had to start with the whole level again. I did it!
My gosh. You did it?
I did it. I finished Castlevania 3, and I said, I'm never doing that again.
I never beat Battletoads because that game was so cheap.
Oh, I never came close. I don't even think I tried.
I got to the final level.
Oh, good for you. Sure as hell farther than I got.
I would use the warps because I could never beat that snake level.
Oh, the thing was ridiculous.
That snake level was too hard.
Yeah, and now we're going to get so many people descending on us. No wonder you couldn't finish Fire Emblem Cat. You can't even finish Battletoads. Oh my god.
I mean,
god.
It's a very different animal, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I think grinding is a part of it. I think one of the mistakes that I made was that I used too many characters in my party.
Mm-hmm.
That I should have actually cut out some members and had a much smaller kind of elite unit.
Yeah, it's funny that like a lot of newer Fire Emblem games, they give you that one sort of elite unit who can destroy anything on the map, but you're not supposed to become over-reliant on them.
Yeah, what's funny is that you don't really have that as much in this game. I guess the main characters are kind of like that type of character, mm-hmm. but no, it's more like just some characters aren't very good. Like Tobin is not very good.
I think you mentioned him.
And if you use him, then he's going to soak up XP that could be better used, that could go to other characters instead.
Right.
And as a result, like, you are watering down your party, and unless you grind and grind and grind, like, you're going to have a hard time keeping up with the difficulty curve.
Mm-hmm. And,
I regret not having a leaner and meaner party.
Yeah, that's good advice, actually, when I pick up the game. But, I was also wondering if you read Jeremy Parrish's, opinions on the game, because he seems to really like it, but he hasn't finished it either, so.
So, no, I did not read it. I'm sure that he has some interesting thoughts on it. I know that he is a Tactics Ogre guy.
Yeah.
And an Ogre Battle guy. So, like, I imagine that he was probably looking at them in that context.
That's interesting. Because I haven't read the thoughts either, but I have seen him mention on Twitter a couple of times that so far is his favorite Fire Emblem game.
I could totally see that, because I think it's, like I said, it's a massive breath of fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love, like, the structure,
mm-hmm.
right? I love the world maps. I love the characters on either side that you can pick up at any time. I like that it's kind of a little more old school in its storytelling and mm-hmm. its character design than newer Fire Emblem games. And, like, in the early going, at least, it's, like, tactical. It feels good, right?
Right.
It's just not until... But then later, you just start going, this is BS.
Screw this.
There's this one enemy that, like, it doesn't matter how high your level is, she will take you down to 1 HP.
Ooh.
Ugh. And you will die. And that's that.
Yeah.
So pretty much the only way to beat her is to teleport Alm up to her and kill her and then pray.
Yeah.
Because otherwise she's just going to start reducing your party to like 1 HP. And they will die, and if you're playing on classic mode, they're dead, and that's that.
Can
because
she, like,
she's standing up on a parapet,
yeah.
So you can't really get to her. You have to,
oh.
like, you. Otherwise, you'd have to go all the way around.
Okay, and she can cast it a long distance?
She can cast at distance, but also there's Cantors who are going to be sending...
Stupid Cantors, man.
She's going to be sending waves of enemies at you. And then there's also, like, poison. Like poison swamps.
And there's poison.
There's not poison swamps on her. That's on Celica's side.
Oh, Jesus.
And then you're already dealing with like attrition on your party because like you're running out of HP by casting spells. So your party is like constantly ticking downward. And until much later in the game, like really late, you do not have healing spells. You don't have a lot of healing spells.
Really?
Like it, you have like... Like initially, you basically have one healer per party.
Mm-hmm.
And Celica's party, Celica is that healer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dear.
And it takes a while for that healing to kind of, like, appear and become, like, more consistent. And without a lot of healers, it's a real pain. So you really got to keep everybody together.
Mm-hmm. Kind of clumped together.
Because one of the main healing things in this game is food.
Yummy.
Like, everybody has food. They restore varying degrees of HP. They will also cure fatigue when you're in the dungeons, because when you're fighting in the dungeons, you will like gradually become more fatigued. Mm-hmm. I think that's like to kind of counterweight like just grinding in the dungeons. Like right. they want you to have to like have a cost of some sort, I guess, and that's mm-hmm. where fatigue comes in from into. But So, you want to keep everybody next to the main character because they have access to the convoy, which is where all the food is. And they can carry, like, they can basically carry a weapon or a piece of food.
Make it both. They can't carry both.
They can only carry a weapon or a piece of food. So you really have to have them attached at all times to Alm or somebody so they can access the convoy and get food as they need it. But sometimes, like, everybody kind of gets pulled apart a little bit. And, yeah, so you have to be really disciplined when you're playing this game or you're going to get steamrolled.
Wow. Well, kudos to the bad guys for, like, just showing no quarter.
Yeah, absolutely. But like I said, like, from a remake standpoint, it's really handsome. They expand the number of characters. The story is much expanded. The original Fire Emblem Gaiden, like, the story, like, was mostly told through the manual.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So now, like, it's a story.
Mm-hmm.
And the... And like I said, like, the world map is, like, really richly realized. And I love the sense of progression in it. And I like that I can go back and forth between the two characters. Has a great soundtrack.
Yeah, from what I've heard, it sounds great.
Yes, it does sound great. So I really have a love-hate relationship with this game.
It sure sounds like it.
Like, I really, on the one hand, like, I'm kind of with Jeremy. It's like, well, oh, man, it's like one of my favorite Fire Emblems. This is great, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard for me to recommend.
Yeah, see, I don't love grinding, but I don't hate it by any means. So I feel like if I just kind of spend a day listening to my own music and just, like, you know, My Chemical Romance, Fire Emblem, I'll be all right.
My Chemical Romance Fire Emblem.
Yeah. I can see it happen. Gerard Way's a huge nerd.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so it's hard for me to recommend in the sense of, like, it's just a pain in the ass to play at times, and it's mm-hmm. not always fun. Mm-hmm. Like, I take exception to cheap design. I do.
Right, I don't blame
and
you for
I think
that.
This game gets too cheap. It's not fun.
I wonder how it will go across with, I mean, let's face it, Fire Emblem only very recently became, like, such a huge franchise, so I wonder how it'll really echo with the people, so to speak, who came in with Awakening and Birthright and all that.
Hmm. I guess we'll see, won't we?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's already being positioned as, like, for the hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the hardcore are the ones who are going to be, like, defending it most vociferously.
They're probably going to be
guessing that they're probably going to be listening to this podcast like casual.
But they're probably going to be like, oh, finally, because, you know, let's face it, the other Fire Emblem games have not been quite as hard as they could have been in the past.
I just take exception to grinding being a thing that is the answer to all ills, because mm-hmm. I think that's just a very outdated concept.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that's kind of a thing in, like, Dragon Quest, and, like, it goes back to Dragon Quest and that kind of thing, but...
But it's funny, even thinking about it,
modern... It's 2017, like...
Yeah.
You don't have to artificially extend the life of a game by asking people to grind to get through challenges. And I know that it's trying to be faithful to the original, but sometimes you can be faithful to a fault, which is why I picked that headline.
Yeah, no, that was a good headline. And, I mean, Dragon Quest VII, that was 100 hours, and don't require... I don't remember spending too much of that time grinding. I just went from challenge to challenge without an issue.
Yeah, I like well-designed maps. I like enemies that aren't cheap BS, like the
canters.
They are. They really are. Like, it's so annoying. Like, I like mechanics that don't involve constant attrition.
Mm-hmm.
So...
No, that's fair.
But beyond that, it's really good.
I think I will definitely give it a try because I am not against grinding. So
yeah, man. I'm so conflicted on this game. So conflicted. But are you enjoying Shadows of Valentia? Drop me a line on Twitter @_catbot or on at usgamer at usgamer.net and let me know your thoughts. I'm sure people will have plenty of things to say in the comments, as mm-hmm. they always do.
It's just, I love hearing the name Cantor, because I know that's like a religious figure, like someone who stands up there and leads the prayer service. And just remember growing up and like going to synagogue, they were always these ancient people who seemed to be from another world. So it's kind of suitable.
I suppose it is. Oh, yeah, and screw the witches.
Screw the witches, too. Subnote, screw the witches.
Because they can teleport around the map, and they are death on your armored units.
Oh, my God. This sounds like it's murder.
So, like, they will, like, teleport and flank your party. And usually your flyers and your cavalry can take them out, because they're mobile and they're mm-hmm. hard-hitting.
Mm-hmm.
But other characters like can't even really scratch them. Like it can be really variable.
And your little dog.
So like often it becomes almost a rock, paper, scissors things of like, oh, here comes that enemy. Okay, I know that this character is gonna be able to take them out mm-hmm. in like a hurry, but crap, they're gonna get to my like armored frontline unit like before I can do anything. But meanwhile, like waves of enemies are coming at the armored unit, and the armored unit is just able to like kind of hold them off.
Yeah.
But of course they can outflank you like really well. So like protecting your flanks can be like super tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up having to kind of protect your flanks with like the main character, like Alm and that kind of thing.
Oh man.
And so much going on at once.
I was going to say, at the very least, it sounds like it sure isn't a boring game.
No, it's not boring at all.
Yeah.
It's just frustrating.
Aggravating.
One game that's not has not been frustrating, though I found it frustrating back in 2006, was Final Fantasy XII, The Zodiac Age. Which
yeah, you got to play that.
I have been playing for the past couple weeks and did a fairly in-depth review of just recently for the site. You should go check it out. I was talking about kind of gaining perspective on kind of an old black sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And Nadia, I was wondering, like, what are your memories of Final Fantasy XII coming out?
I know that I have it, and I didn't play it.
I know that I have it, Nadia.
That's the gamer credo. I know that I have it. That's about it. But I have it. I haven't gotten a chance to play it. My husband still badgers me about that, because he bought it for me. It's in one of the steel cases.
You're a bad wife.
I'm terrible. I'm an awful wife.
Did you not play in the video game that your husband bought for you?
Yes, I'm very ashamed.
Oh, you even got it in the steel bookcase, huh?
Yeah. The
was
thing,
that,
though,
that
is that...
a thing in 2006, huh?
What's that?
That was a thing in 2006, huh?
Apparently. Apparently. It was like some sort of anniversary thing. It was nice. But the thing with me and the PlayStation 2 is that I missed out on a lot of the RPGs at that time because I didn't have a PlayStation 2. I was very, very poor. So I had money for one game system, and we bought the GameCube. And that did not have Final Fantasy XII on it.
So are you me? Because that was pretty much me.
What's
I
that?
That was pretty much me. I did not get a GameCube until 2003.
Oh, okay.
Or I got a GameCube in 2003, and I did not get a PS2 until 2005. And the reason I got the GameCube was because it was only like $70.
Mm-hmm.
Because a friend of mine was willing to basically, like, we split the system. And the system was like $150 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cute.
It was cheap, like it was maybe even as low as $200, and he just wanted the game
mm-hmm.
because it had the pack-in of all the Zelda games.
Oh yeah, I had like two copies of that. I gave one to my friend who I worked with at the time.
Yeah, packed in like Zelda 1 and 2 and maybe Ocarina, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it had like another version of Ocarina that had like the Master Quest on it, I think.
So yeah, he really wanted that. So, and this was before Virtual Console was a thing, so this was kind of a big deal for him. So he was willing to go in a little extra to get the game, whereas I just wanted the console.
Mm-hmm.
So I just took the console with me. So I had a GameCube.
Did you have
a lot to play on it?
Basically, you justified the handle then, because you guys were kind of passing it between each other. Here you go.
No,
you
it was
go.
My GameCube.
You didn't oh, get okay. it.
He already had a GameCube. He just wanted the game.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Nope. Not justifying the handle.
Oh, poor handle.
But I got a PS2 in 2005, and I got a copy of Final Fantasy XII in 2006 when it came out in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
This was when I had first moved to Japan, and this was a big deal for me because it was the first time I bought a game that was not yet out in the U.S., and I got to play it before anybody else.
Oh, that must have been nice.
In Japanese.
In Japanese. One caveat. How well did you know Japanese by that point?
Not well enough. Certainly not for a game as complex as Final Fantasy XII.
Yeah, that's a bit wordy.
But more than that, like, Final Fantasy XII was a game that... In 2006, I had never played an MMORPG. I had never, like, I was used to Japanese RPGs that for the most part, either they were like pure action where it's like hack slash whatever, or they were pure turn-based. Pick the thing from the menu, do the thing. Final Fantasy XII's weird hybrid of those elements really confused the hell out of me, and I did not know what to make of it in 2006.
Oh.
I was afraid of the gambits, Nadia.
I can understand why. The gambits were very strange.
Oh, what did you think of the gambits when they were being like kind of revealed and everything?
To be honest, I started really falling out of love with the Final Fantasy with the Final Fantasy's battle systems like after 9 because they were trying so many weird things by that point, and I just got intimidated and ran away.
So like being able to swap in characters and everything?
Yeah, just I was so used to like Final Fantasy 6, you know, here is your party, if you don't like it, go back to the airship sort of thing. So
Which is funny because 10 was like really straightforward for the most part. Like all you had to really do was just follow the license board, or not the license board, the thing.
Yeah.
The orbs.
Yeah.
Just follow that, and also you can swap in characters at any time. You're good to go. And they have like defined roles. It's almost like Dragon Quest, to be honest.
Yeah, but I guess Dragon Quest always struck me as a little less intimidating because everything's so cartoony and happy.
And it's also very simple in the sense of like you level up, you get abilities. You're not like making any choices or anything, right? Like you're not looking at the big orb board.
God, the orb boards.
People are going to give me like so much trouble for not remembering what the heck this thing is called.
I think it had the word grid in it.
The sphere grid.
That's it. Yeah.
That's the one.
It had the word grid.
Orb boards.
Orby orbies.
But Final Fantasy XII. Yeah, like, I did not know what to make of it at all. I remember that there was a lot of stuff making fun of it. Like, Penny Arcade posted a really snarky comic of Mario, but, like, Mario doing the gambits and just kind of moving on his own through the game. And I was like, this game plays itself.
Oh, were you like that?
Why would you want to play this game? Like, it plays itself, literally. Like, there's no game to this.
Oh man, and that, is that when you had that fight with Parrish over it?
Oh no, that was until 2009.
Oh okay, you've since grown and accepted Final Fantasy XII into your bosom.
My bosom. Yes, kind of.
Kind of.
Okay, so I was playing Final Fantasy XII HD, and it's interesting because I feel like I'm older and wiser, and maybe more versed in the RPGs, and I've played more MMORPGs, so the gambits, like, as a system, just make a lot more sense to me now. And it's pretty simple, actually. You come up with kind of commands, and you want the ones that are the highest priority at the top. And so it's like, oh, like, I want to make sure that these people are always healed. So please ensure that when they fall into this level of health, that they will prioritize healing.
Right.
Otherwise, just keep attacking.
Right, so that is very much like Dragon Quest.
I suppose, yeah. Except that you're automating all of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you're not like actually just clicking on the commands. You're just saying, you're setting it all up in advance.
How about the cast? Are they, like, I've always been kind of curious about them because I don't know too much about Final Fantasy XII's cast, but I like their designs.
And Final Fantasy XII is kind of a mystery to you, huh?
A little bit, yeah. I know the main character's named Vaughn, and he doesn't wear a shirt. And he got made fun of it for in, Dissidia. Yeah, that was it.
He was getting made fun of in Dissidia for not wearing a shirt?
Somebody made a comment, or he made a comment to someone about how he's shirtless. And it makes sense, though, because he lives in the sky, so isn't that kind of chilly?
He doesn't live in the sky. He lives in the desert.
So, okay, but he goes in the sky, doesn't he?
He's a wannabe sky pirate, yeah.
Okay, so wear a shirt, and then he could be a sky pirate.
So it's interesting, actually, because it's kind of a combination of elements of Final Fantasy Tactics and Vagrant Story in Times of the World, like in the aesthetic. Like, there's actually a strong Vagrant Story feel to it.
Yeah, and it's the same world, if I'm not mistaken.
Which is makes sense because it was made by Matsuno,
who
also did Vagrant Story and Final Fantasy Tactics. But it so it has a handful of characters who are introduced at the start. We have Vaughn and Pinello, who is like male and female characters. Vaughn is kind of a street rat living in an occupied city of Rabanastre in a country called Dalmascus, which has been invaded by the evil empire.
Of course.
Think Valkyria Chronicles in this instance, but instead of, you know, yeah, so like the evil empire has invaded them, and like at the very beginning of the game, you see the attack, and you see the king is about to sign a deal with the empire to make them kind of a vassal state of this empire. But a character, seemingly a character named Bash, B-A-S-C-H, Bash, comes in and says that this is a traitor king and kills him.
Cool.
And in response, the empire says, ah, well, we were going to be nice to you, but instead we're going to take you over. Oh. Like, we're going to occupy you. You're set like, up, you lose up. All rights. Hmm. Good job, you. And Bosch is taken away and clapped in chains, put in jail.
Right.
Scene shifts to Vaughn, who's a street rat. He's in the sewers. He's killing rats. He's running errands in a very MMORPG kind of fashion. Mm-hmm. Like, bring this to this, bring this to that, do this, kill this guy, you know, that kind of thing. And interestingly, Vaughn and Pinello, they were added in after the fact, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the rumor is, or the report is, that initially Square or Matsuno intended for Bosch to be the main character.
Yeah, that would make sense.
But instead, but Japan was like, but Bosch is like this grizzled, kind of older grizzled guy.
Oh, right? We don't want to play as him. We want to play as the young kid.
Yeah, they wanted you to play as characters who can be related to by Japanese a Japanese audience. So they introduced Vaughn and Pinello.
Japan doesn't like shirts?
Japan hates shirts. It's a land of shirtlessness.
My utopia.
Well, no, Japan loves... Yes, Japan loves shirts. That's why Vaughn. Here we go. So they introduce these characters. But I think it's actually useful in the sense that he becomes an audience surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
So you see how things are in the city from a ground level. Right?
Okay, yeah.
You see what it's like to live in this on a day-to-day basis. We were talking about earlier today... Or we were talking earlier in this podcast about how Destiny feels sterile.
Right.
Like, it's just a series of interconnected levels. Like, the lore is almost pointless because you don't feel like you have a sense of fighting for anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally the opposite in Final Fantasy XII, where the cities feel lively and bustling. And you are at very much a street level with Vaughn from the very start. Mm-hmm. And Vaughn quickly becomes embroiled in events larger than him. When he infiltrates the palace to steal a thing and runs into a sky pirate, a grounded sky pirate named Baltier, you would love.
Yeah, I think great. I know who he is.
British accent, the whole nine yards.
The usual.
I'm playing in Japanese. He has like kind of that smug, like, I'm a pirate kind of voice.
The I'm a pirate accent.
And he also has his companion, Fran, who looks kind of like a bunny.
Aw.
She has like bunny ears and everything, but she's also wearing basically lingerie and spiked battle heels.
Whatever gets the job done.
And she's an archer/mage.
Hmm.
And everybody's kind of thrown together and you end up rescuing Bosch. And things start to happen and you meet a woman who is, I believe, the princess at the beginning of the game, but now she's leading the resistance.
La resistance.
And you have the beginnings of a party.
Well, that sounds interesting.
And it is interesting. It starts off so well.
Yeah, that's really... I like RPGs that really start off with a bang. That's Persona 5 was really fantastic that way. It slows down a bit afterwards, but I do love that, like, big intro that gets you into the whole thing.
So here's the interesting thing about Final Fantasy XII. Matsuno like kind of famously didn't finish it and was actually replaced. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole story about how Final Fantasy XII was supposed to come out like 2 years earlier, mm-hmm. like say circa 2004.
Wow.
If it came out in like 2004, they could have squeezed in 13 on the PS2 because 13 was supposed to be on the PS2.
Wow.
But Final Fantasy XII was way off schedule, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the Final Fantasy X came out in like 2001. Final Fantasy XI came out like the year after. And then there was like a 4-year drought.
Yeah, and that drought kind of persisted from game to game.
Yeah, and it threw everything off. Like, mm-hmm. Square had a kind of a factory system going on with Final Fantasy up to that point.
They did, yeah.
And they were producing them like bam, bam, bam. Mm-hmm. And they... So Final Fantasy XII like comes around in 2006, and everybody's like, "What the heck is this? This does not look like Final Fantasy. This isn't like Final Fantasy X." Mm. There was famously a story where like a Japanese kid comes up, the first person to get Final Fantasy XII, bows to Square Enix's CEO and says, "Please remake Final Fantasy VII."
Well, kid, guess what?
And Final Fantasy XII like becomes kind of a black sheet because nobody knows what to do with it. Mm-hmm. Matsuno leaves halfway through. A lot of people would say that the story falls away apart halfway through. Mm-hmm. That's my recollection, but I don't remember very well. And it was taken over by Kawazu, who did various other things and is known for being a bit zany.
That's just what Final Fantasy XII needs, zaniness. The story about like political upheaval.
Yes, people were saying that like it goes from kind of a serious-minded political story to something a little crazier, and then you can feel it in the characters, which I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Have you finished the game?
I mean, I'm in the midst of playing it.
You're getting there.
In the midst of playing a preview build.
Right, that's right.
I will be streaming in an hour and a half from the recording of this podcast.
Oh, boy.
But so far, I'm really enjoying it. I mean... The only thing that I'm a little nervous about is that it feels kind of passive at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because if you set up your gambits right, you just have to push forward and they'll do everything for you.
Yeah, well, a lot of RPGs can be like that, though. I mean, like, I find I'm going through Persona 5 just pressing start a lot to let my characters, like, take care of the enemies.
I mean, that is the case, right? Mm. Like, yeah, sure, you're pushing... You're interacting with the menu to select a spell or something to hit the weak point of an enemy. But really, it's not that deep when mm-hmm. it comes down to it. You are essentially automating your actions.
Yeah.
In effect, you're introducing a script that does all the busy work for you while you do the higher level thinking of setting up gambits that are going to work on a particular boss. Because mm-hmm. it does get... a lot more tactical as it goes on. Like, they have like buffs and debuffs. You have to think about,
yeah,
like, what am I gonna do when they do this and that kind of thing. So I can see the argument, but all I do know is that I spent a lot of time in sewers in that game.
That's like, very MMO.
Like, I was constantly in sewers.
Yeah.
And also, I not only was I in sewers a lot, once I got gambits, I was just pushing forward, and whenever enemies showed up, I would just kill them and mm-hmm. keep going. Mm-hmm. And, like, I never got below, like, 50% health, and the only time that happened was when I was fighting a boss who did an area of effect attack. Mm-hmm. That was kind of nasty, but I quickly healed myself. And actually, I think that boss is meant to be a test for gambits, because if you just try and use the menu all the time, like, you will die, because yeah. you can't heal fast enough.
Yeah, that's a very Squaresoft tactic right there, is they give you this boss that you have to know how to beat, and you have to kind of use something you've learned, or else you will get demolished. I mean, look at Final Fantasy VII has that weird scorpion thing. Final Fantasy VI has that, like, the Mist Dragon. Basically, those all exist to, like, teach you how to use the ATB. Mm-hmm. So I can understand why Final Fantasy XII would have that, like, tutorial boss.
But... from a remake standpoint, Final Fantasy XII was really good.
Nice.
Because it still looks kind of like a PS2 game mm-hmm. in the sense that the NPCs are not very detailed and like the level geometry is like kind of simple.
Yeah.
And the main characters often look really great. Mm-hmm. But the textures aren't kind of as nuanced as they are now.
Yeah.
Which I guess is to be expected. But it has the English and Japanese language track.
Mm.
It has a fully reorchestrated soundtrack, which sounds really good.
Mm-hmm.
Like the soundtrack in this game is excellent. It has this kind of high adventure feel to it that I really like. And it also introduces an improved version of the license board. So in the original Final Fantasy XII, you had this big board mm-hmm. that you kind of start out at, and you would put in a point. It would open up more stuff.
Right.
And you had to put in points for the right to equip things, like equip items and that kind of thing. I found it really annoying.
Yeah.
And you could kind of craft classes for your characters by doing that.
Right.
But it was not very intuitive, and it kind of made everybody feel kind of samey.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, you pick a class for everybody. You have the Zodiac.
Right.
You have the 12 classes that you can choose from. And you once you assign a character to a class, they're assigned to it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that class is filled, and that character is stuck in that class. And then as they move up the board, like they unlock stuff specific to that class.
That's interesting.
I like how much more directed it feels.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Although not being able to change your class, that's kind of weird.
I feel I did a whole bunch of research beforehand to be like, oh, what class should I go with? Because I was like, I don't know, like, which classes are good? And, like, I think you would naturally want to make Vaughn into, like, a hunter.
Yeah.
And, or, like, Baltier into a hunter because he has, like, a gun. And that's kind of a gun bow class.
Mm-hmm.
Or you would want to make Fran into, like, a mage of some sort. Like, you would want to take advantage of what they naturally look like. But
yeah.
Vaughn is actually better as a knight.
Really?
Yeah, he has really good stats for that kind of stuff.
Isn't that usually
Baltier
like
is
a
one
tank?
Of the best white mages?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I have him healing a lot and that kind of thing. But one thing that's annoying me is that I can't keep Baltier's guns now that I've made him a white mage because I can't level up to the next round of guns.
Right.
Like, I can't get, like, level 2 guns and attach them to a white mage. It's all staves now and rods.
Ah, come on. We got to have a white mage with some guns. Come on, Squaresoft.
Indeed. So Final Fantasy XII, The Zodiac Age, is coming out in July. I'm going to keep playing it. I will have more thoughts on it. But so far, I think that a game that was kind of overlooked and some people regard as a black sheep maybe deserves another chance.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to it. It is definitely one of my must-plays this summer. So we'll be talking a lot about it over Axe God, I'm sure.
Yes, we will. Okay. So, Nadia, you will recall last week we talked about Skyrim and how it's not the best RPG of all time.
How could I forget?
We asked some people had thoughts. They responded. Here's one from Rene DaCosta. Skyrim, I don't think it's the best of all time, and I like your defense. And like your defense of Dark Souls, there is a reason why people feel strongly about it and why it has influenced a lot of things from Dragon Age Inquisition to Breath of the Wild. You say the story stinks, which is mostly true, and the combat is shallow, okay. But you do more things than just that, and this is what is special about Bethesda games, the breadth of options. My ex liked to steal everything, forks, stones, bowls, and get in scuffs with city guards to increase her infamy level. I think that's cool.
That is pretty funny.
I played a big beefy Nord swinging around my Conan sword for the greater glory of Krom, but was pretty lawful neutral, except when I'm a master lockpicker.
Yep.
While the story wants to railroad you one way or another, the fact that I'm able to really play my character in any way and make your own sort of meta-narrative,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that you can interact in all ways, it sort of means it's a jack-of-all-trades, master of none. Oh, and it's better than Chrono Trigger.
Oh, no. Oh, dear. I was on board until that last statement right there. Oh.
Thoughts, Nadia?
I definitely see where they're coming from. One thing I mentioned in my review of Skyrim Remastered is I said it's a very unique Bethesda kind of experience that I can only excuse them for, and to kind of get clear about that. I've talked so much about Skyrim with my friends, and it's not just stories of like, oh man, I killed this dragon, or oh man, you know, I saved this town. It's all about these weird ass glitches that worked in my favor and are just so freaking hilarious that they're so special. Like, I'll never get over how there's this one Argonian named Talon G, And you can do two things for him through your quests. Number one, you can to get to the Thieves Guild, you have to basically blackmail his mate. And that really pisses him off for reasons that you can understand. But you can also help him get a wedding ring for his mate. And that really makes him happy. So one time I go up to him and I talk to him, and he's like, after I've done these things for him, and I talk to him, and he says, "You've done us a kindness we can never repay, friend. And there's the door. Why don't you go use it?" Because he was so confused, he didn't know what the hell to say. And it's a terrible, such awful, sloppy programming, but it's just so funny. I can never help bring it up over and over again. It's just, that's such a unique Bethesda experience. Like, that's one of the reasons I love Skyrim so much. And I know it's such a sloppy, stupid reason, but I can't get over it.
So one reaction that a lot of people had in the comments for this episode, they started making their own top 10 lists.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
So for example, Chaotic Beat, his top 10 RPGs, just for kicks, his or her. I apologize for gendering you, Chaotic Beat. But one, SMT Nocturne. Interesting choice.
Yeah.
Two, Demon's Souls. Ooh.
Wow.
We got a Demon's Souls hipster here. Three, Shadow Hearts. Four, Bloodborne. Five, Zelda Breath of the Wild. What? Zelda's Breath of the Wild? It's an RPG.
Rubble.
Yeah, whatever. It's grandfathered in. Six, Digital Devil Saga. Very interesting choice again. We're enjoying these PS2 SMT games, I see. Seven, Shadow Hearts 2 Covenant. Eight, SMT Strange Journey. Nine, Persona 3. And 10, Front Mission 4.
Oh, what was Front Mission 4? What was that for?
I think that was for the PS2.
Wow, some really nice PS2 selections here.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people feel like the PS2 is the best RPG console of all time. I think I would disagree with that, but certainly had a lot of them.
Yeah, we should really have an episode about that. What was the best RPG console of all time? Unless we did it and I completely forgot about it.
Oh, best RPG console of all time. Oh, interesting. I feel like I would have to play Devil's Advocate and pick something other than the Super Nintendo just to be able to go against you, because otherwise we're just going to sit there and agree the entire episode.
Well, honestly, my selection was PS1.
Oh, okay. Maybe we will have an episode then. All right. One more question before we wrap up for this episode. This one's from Justin Smith, and this is kind of interesting. He said, "I am seeing news articles about the low sales of Obsidian's latest game, Tyranny," which is true. Yes, we wrote about it, actually. Tyranny did not do well. If you'll recall, Tyranny was the isometric RPG by Obsidian, which allowed you to pick different... basically, you're the bad guy. You're working for an emperor, you're working with different factions to pacify, rebellions and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think we talked about it.
And you can join the rebellion, or you can keep being evil. And ultimately, it doesn't matter, you're going to piss off one faction or the other. And, evil devours itself. It's an interesting game. I liked the story. The combat was decent. But it was wholly overlooked, including by us. We did not review it.
Oh, guilty.
And I think that's because another rather large RPG was coming out at the same time, and I was very busy at that time. That's why I could not review it. I think it was Final Fantasy 15, but I could be wrong. It was either Pokemon or Final Fantasy 15.
I seem to remember Final Fantasy 15. It was around that time.
Yeah, it was around that time. Anyway, Justin says, "One thing I have noticed has been the lack of any examination or comment on the U.S. political climate in which the game was released. I was looking forward to sinking my teeth into a choice-filled RPG over the holidays and intended to buy it, but when the results of the U.S. election happened, I and my partner decided to hold off on Tyranny for the time being until we were ready to explore the issue the game focuses on. I can't help but think this played a part in the game's low sales. Anyway, I love the show." Interesting thought, but I'm not sure, because it's just so wholly different, right?
Yeah. But I do very much like the idea of, it's not even an idea, I guess it's kind of a semi-fact, that a political climate can affect a game's sales.
Can you give me an example?
No. I do know that the GameCube came out in Japan in right after 9/11, and I know that's not an exact example, but I do remember some people thinking that really... muffled the sales of the GameCube at the time.
Oh, so in the sense of people weren't ready to
That's what I mean. I mean, like,
video games at that time, they were feeling like they had been kind of punched in the stomach.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm thinking. People, I'm not really talking about like, oh, I can't deal with these themes so much as I'm not in the mood to deal with these themes.
I'm not in the mood to play video games, to be honest.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because video games are escapist, but I mean, when the heavy stuff is going on, I suppose it can be kind of rough. I do know that 9/11 more or less killed Mobile Suit Gundam's run on Toonami here in the U.S.
That's right, yeah.
Because it was like, because it was a war anime, it was canceled.
Was it outright canceled?
It was either canceled or severely delayed. It was already not that popular because they were trying to shoehorn a 1970s anime with a terrible dub onto a show for onto a network for effectively teenagers and early college students who were definitely not old enough to remember that and were mostly subsisting on mid-90s anime. But it definitely hurt it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another game that might have been another anime that might have been delayed because of 9/11 as well.
I know that Donnie Darko was just destroyed in the theaters because of 9/11.
Was it?
It was. Like, I don't know if it was. It wasn't censored, but there's a scene, of course, with, I don't know if you've seen Donnie Darko, have you?
I have not, but I'm familiar with it.
Well, it involves a crashing airplane, put it that way.
Oh, yeah. Right. Okay, yeah, I remember. That's the end, I think. So. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
But it didn't take much
back
then. Yeah,
I can see that. People were feeling a little sensitive about it at that time.
Yeah.
As for the game Tyranny, I suppose the name Tyranny could like serve as kind of a trigger for certain people who are like feeling really low about the election at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I really separated it out in my mind because
one was
like medieval fantasy. You're playing as like kind of the evil Game of Thronesy connoisseur or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're dealing with warring factions, but like it just does. In my view, it did not have a lot to do with modern politics.
Right.
So. But, I mean, it was definitely an interesting time for video games right in the wake of that election. Because I know that I was not super interested in talking about video games right after that happened. So.
Same.
But I digress. I do think that the real reason that it ended up having bad sales was that it just wasn't marketed very well.
Yeah.
It did not have kind of the, because like Pillars of Eternity, like it was marketed as the return to the isometric RPG. It mm-hmm. was one of the first waves of Kickstarters. It was by the old, like, it was like, it was billed as a return to the ethos of Black Isle Studios. It had that kind of cachet to it.
Right.
And Tyranny, when it was announced the following year, or maybe the 2 years after that, like, it almost felt like a side project, and I remember getting pulled into like a couple meetings to like check it out and everything, but it didn't feel like it just didn't feel like as big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And with all due respect to the people who did great work on Tyranny, it felt like the A team of Obsidian was on Pillars of Eternity, like guys like Josh Sawyer, and the other guys like weren't as well recognized, right? And that's kind of the cruelty of having, you know, like games are made by a lot of people, but people tend to associate them with a few well-known figures.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's kind of what happened with Tyranny. That's the tyranny of game development.
Wordplay.
And then finally, it just came out on top. It came out in a very busy season.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it did not get reviewed by a lot of outlets because a lot of outlets were very busy. I know Polygon, like, it fell between the cracks for Polygon, because Phil was, like me, very busy mm-hmm. with other RPGs, like, so, as a consequence, Tyranny, unfortunately, did not do well. I hope Obsidian itself ends up being able to kind of pick it up a little bit and do okay with Pillars of Eternity 2 Deadfire, but, yeah, it's kind of a drag. I want Obsidian to do well.
Yeah, I'm not, like, a huge fan of their games, but I'm a big fan of what they do.
Yes, I am. All right. I think that's the end of our episode, Nadia. It's time to wrap this one up. Axe of the Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Do me a favor. If you're listening to us on Stitcher, could you leave us a review and also leave us a review on iTunes? We'd really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a nice one. We always like to hear from you if you're enjoying the podcast. And of course, that makes us more visible.
Yes.
On the iTunes charts, and hopefully lets people know that the Blood God is there for those who love RPGs. You can find us on all of the social media channels, iTunes, Twitter, the _Catbot, US GamerNet, Facebook, US GamerNet, Nadia. You can be found on Twitter at Nadia Oxford, and of course on your blog, Tiny Girl, Tiny Games. Is there anything this week you want to highlight, Nadia, in terms of what you've written?
Let's see, what have I written this week? I wrote the Game Genie ad that we all talked about earlier.
Yes. I like that we managed to make that into like a smallish topic on this episode.
Yeah.
Synergy.
I'm trying to think. I highlighted a video that I found of Chrono Trigger. Someone basically peeled back the layers, literally, of the game and kind of exposed a few secrets. I thought that was really neat.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely something that people should go check out. And actually, on that note, I should probably beat Chrono Trigger now.
Yes, please do.
And you got to finish Persona 4 Golden.
Yes, I do.
We'll do it.
I will.
I got like so many games to play, like this big stack of games. I was like playing Shadows of Valentia, mm-hmm. finally wrapped that up. I had Final Fantasy XII. I've been playing that. But meanwhile, and then I keep getting distracted by Heroes of the Storm.
Yeah, and what about Persona 5? Are you getting back into that?
Oh my god, I got to get into that too, and I'm going to need to finish Breath of the Wild. I'm going to be able to finish all these
too many
games. There are too many good ones.
It's not a good political scene, but the game scene is just like, holy crap.
Yes, it is. But we will be back, as always, to talk more about RPGs, the genre that we love, next week. Keep following us every Friday. But until then, I've been Kat Bailey, and for Nadia and myself, thanks for listening. We'll see you again one more time. Happy adventuring.